Welcome back to Lit City. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Anna Williams. And today we're going to start our show in one of the most iconic spots that commemorates Lit City. It's a place where the words of some of the greatest Iowa-connected writers are literally written in the ground. It's the famous Literary Walk on Iowa Avenue.
And this Literary Walk was put into place between 2000 and 2001. It's made up of a series of bronze relief panels featuring quotations from fiction and poetry, some cool imagery as well. And these panels are literally set into the sidewalk of Iowa Avenue.
And this is in one of the busiest parts of Iowa City, really. It's the three blocks between Clinton Street and Gilbert Street, right where the downtown area meets the University of Iowa campus. Basically, it's also in the shadow of that iconic gold-domed old Capitol building.
So while students were rushing to classes and people were out on their lunch breaks running in and out of restaurants, we took a slow and somewhat irreverent walk down the famed Lit Walk.
I've lived in Iowa City for 4 years now, and I've never walked the Literary Walk and just read everything.
Me neither. And I've lived here for 7 years. I've read some of them, though. You always read some of them.
Yeah.
So we're going to walk down the street here and read what we find. And I'll start with this one. In May, when the grass turns green and the lilies fill the air with purple perfumes and the orioles tell of orchards bursting with pink blossoms, then the boys, old and young, get out their bats and balls and run to the pastures and play the wonderful game of baseball. That's by Frederick Manfred from No Fun on Sunday.
Okay. One of my favorites here.
One of my favorites, too, and from one of my favorite books by one of my favorites.
Okay, here we go. I better not screw it up. There are a lot of hats on this one, and the quote says, "We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be." Kurt Vonnegut.
And it doesn't say what book, but it's Mother Night. Oh, Jane Smiley, an Iowa favorite for sure. "I have noticed before that there is a category of acquaintanceship that is not friendship or business or romance, but speculation, fascination." And that's from Ordinary Love and Goodwill.
Haven't read that one either.
Me neither. Don't tell Jane.
So now we are facing a plaque that is shaped like the state of Iowa, and the county of Monterey is highlighted, as well as the city of Vandemar. And this is a quotation from Herbert Quick's Vandemark's Folly. "The work of writing the history of this township, I mean Vandemark Township, Monterey County, state of Iowa, has been turned over to me." Excellent quotation. Moving.
I have one of Herbert Quick's novels on my shelf.
He was a novelist? Because from that, I really thought he was like a cartographer of Iowa.
I think so, if I'm remembering correctly. But I've not actually read one. And now, Flannery O'Connor. "Everywhere I go, I'm asked if I think the universities stifle writers. My opinion is that they don't stifle enough of them."
Wow.
Ba-dum-bum.
That's some shade from Flannery O'Connor to end our Literary Walk.
So, despite what Flannery O'Connor may have had to say about it, the Literary Walk celebrates some of the most famous writers and thinkers that ever spent time in the state of Iowa. But today we're going to talk about some stories of inspiring Iowans who've gotten a lot less attention.
Right. Today, we have a show that brings awareness to diversity in a couple of ways. Diversity in terms of the types of writing that go on in the city of literature and in terms of the people who have made it great.
Now, of course, we're in a university town, so there is a lot more than just fiction and poetry being created. We've also got scholarly writing being produced at the University of Iowa, other Iowa universities as well. And today, we're going to hear from some scholars who have written about underrecognized Iowans.
So the first interview we'll listen back on is with Jamie Schultz. She is a PhD graduate of the University of Iowa, and she writes about the experience of some of the state's first black athletes and the way their stories have been reshaped in this community over the years. Her book is called Moments of Impact: Injury, Racialized Memory, and Reconciliation in College Football.
Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
For the book that you wrote, you went back and looked deeply into the history of what happened to Jack Trice, what happened to Johnny Bright, and what happened to Ozzie Simmons. And we'll get into their stories here in just a moment. But what was it that set you on this path? Why did you want to revisit this history?
Oh, I love this part of the story. Thank you for asking that question. So I came to the story originally by learning about Ozzie Simmons. And I came to that story through a student of mine. I was teaching at the University of Iowa, and it was a class called Inequality in Sport. We were talking about issues of race and gender and sexuality. And there was a student in the class named Jessamyn Smith, who at the time was a very good wrestler at the University of Iowa. And he told me the real story behind the Floyd of Rosedale Trophy. So Iowa was getting ready to play Minnesota in football, and he said, you know, there's a story behind this trophy that has to do with an African-American football player.
And for people who aren't that closely into Hawkeye football,
this is
a trophy that passes between whoever wins, between Minnesota or Iowa, and it's a statue of a pig.
Exactly, yeah. They've been doing this since 1935, and it actually stems from injuries that Ozzie Simmons sustained in 1934. So I learned that story from Jessamyn, and I did a little digging, and I found the stories of Jack Trice and Johnny Bright, and they just seemed so well connected in my mind that I ended up writing about it.
Okay, well, and let's talk about Ozzie Simmons, and we'll revisit the stories of Trice and Bright as well, but I do think a lot of Iowans are familiar with those stories. Ozzie Simmons' story is told less often. Tell me about him.
Well, so he was born in Texas. He grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, and he was a phenomenal athlete. He and his brother, Don, I think they had something like Ozzie Simmons had maybe 11 varsity letters, and he was just a great athlete. And there's varying stories about how he ended up at the University of Iowa. But he and his brother somehow got on the train, came to Iowa, got off, and found the coach, who at the time was a guy named Ossie Solem, and convinced him to let them try out for the team.
And both of the men were really talented football players, but Ozzie Simmons really shone on the field.
Oh, he was just phenomenal. Yeah, I found some old newsreel footage of him playing, and you just wouldn't believe how good he was. It was at a time when not very many African Americans were allowed to play college football at predominantly white schools. So he was really a standout in a number of ways.
And what was his career at Iowa like?
Well, it was sort of sporadic. You know, he was plagued with injuries. He had fallouts with the coaches. But, you know, from his second game with Iowa, they played Northwestern, and the coach commented that he had seen and played against a lot of great halfbacks, but Ozzie Simmons was the absolute best he'd ever seen.
And tell me what happened at this game with Minnesota.
Okay, so Ozzie Simmons comes to Iowa in 1934 is the first year he's eligible to play varsity. And there's competing accounts of what actually happened to him. We know that he left the game at the end of the second quarter. He was knocked unconscious at least 2 to 3 times during the course of the game. Now, was it rough play that happens in football? Was it because he was such a good player that Minnesota went after him, or was it because he was black? And that's the point of debate really here. But he was seriously injured and he left the game. And nobody made much about it in 1934. But in 1935, the Iowa governor, who was Clyde Herring at the time, made a comment about if the officials stand for any rough tactics like they did last year, I'm sure the Iowa fans won't. And so Minnesota interpreted that as a threat that the Iowa fans were going to spill out of the stands and go after the Minnesota team.
And so things were incredibly tense leading up to this game.
Oh, yeah.
Where did the pig come in?
So the story, it's changed over time, but the story that we usually hear about the Floyd of Rosedale Trophy is that their tensions were high and the two governors made a bet. And it was sort of a silly bet at the time to kind of diffuse these tensions. So Floyd Olson was the governor of Minnesota, and as a way to diffuse tensions, he wrote a telegram to Clyde Herring, the Iowa governor, and said, you know, things are running high, but I'll bet you a prize Minnesota pig against a prize Iowa hog that Minnesota is going to win. And so it was actually a real live hog at the time that they bet on.
All right, and then an artist made a statue, a trophy, so that's been passed back and forth ever since. What happened at that next game?
Minnesota won. They were a really, really good team. And by all accounts, it was a fair contest. You know, they didn't treat Ozzie Simmons gingerly, but they didn't go after him in any way. So it seemed like the bet worked, and things went pretty smoothly, even though Iowa lost.
Now, there is a question of race in this conflict. At the time, in the 30s, a lot of football players were seriously injured on the field of play. Of course, today, a lot of football players get injured. But back then, the protections weren't as good. The rules weren't as firm. Were there any black football players on the Minnesota team?
There were, and that's actually what makes it even more complicated, is that Minnesota was somewhat similar to Iowa in that they had, you know, maybe two, as many as three African-Americans on the team at the time. So that makes it even more complicated, I think.
We don't have as much time as I would like to talk about these stories, but I want to quickly bring people up to speed if they're not familiar with the story of Johnny Bright, who was a remarkable athlete who played not only football, but also was a track athlete and played basketball and softball. He was just an incredible all-around athlete who played at Drake University, and he decided to focus on football. He was an incredible football player. He was in the running for the Heisman Trophy. And in 1951, Drake went to Oklahoma to play Oklahoma State. But it was before it was Oklahoma State. It was Oklahoma A&M at the time in 1951. And it's very clear from evidence, Jamie, that Johnny Bright was targeted during that game.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we're lucky in the sense that we have photographic evidence of a A&M player striking Bright with his forearm repeatedly throughout the game. He only played for about 7 minutes in that game before he was taken out.
And the first strike, he said in after the fact, broke his jaw.
Yeah,
and he continued to play with a broken jaw. Mm-hmm. And that ended his college career. He did go on to play professional football in Canada. He chose to go to Canada, and there are a lot of interesting conversations to be had about that as well. But so with these stories, Jamie, when you are going back and looking at these stories, it's very interesting to note that particularly when you look at the story of Jack Trice, when people were writing about that at the time, the question of race wasn't one that was written about very much. And as we've revisited stories, of course, the question of race is first and foremost in many people's minds.
Right. Yeah, and that's really what the book is about, is about how memory changes over time and the way that people have sort of imbued these stories with racial meaning in ways that they did not at the initial moment of impact.
So what is your perspective on that? I mean, in saying that we imbue these stories with racial conflict, do you think that we are not seeing them as clearly?
No, see, it's such a fascinating phenomenon when this happens. I don't think that one version of history is more correct than the other. It's just the way that we interpret them. So at the time, you know, Jack Trice is a very interesting case. At the time that he was killed, there was a brief mention of race. You know, they wondered if race had anything to do with the injuries he sustained, and that was quickly dismissed. So he was seen as this kind of exalted hero who passed away. He was this victor on a fatal field. It was this romantic version. In the 70s, when they start re-remembering Jack Trice, students see the incident very clearly as being racist. So I don't think one is more correct than the other, but I think it has to do about with the times in which things are remembered, right? So the 70s, it's the height of the civil rights movement. There's all these things going on. Students are very keyed into it. And they, you know, that social context helps them remember things in particular ways.
Looking back at these stories and trying to understand them both in the context of what happened to Jack Trice in the 20s and Johnny Bright in the 50s and Ozzie Simmons in the 30s, and also trying to put them in context from what we know now about racial relations in this country and how we feel about it today, what can we learn from these stories?
I think we have a lot to learn. I mean, if we look at the University of Missouri, right, there were students protesting against these microaggressions, some of the racist and racial tensions on campus, but it's not until football players kind of got involved with it that the president actually resigned, that the country paid attention to what was going on. And so for better or for worse, sport has tremendous power in this country. There was a story at Wyoming not too long after the Iowa story where 14 members, all they wanted to do was wear a black armband because Wyoming was going to play BYU and the Mormon church didn't allow blacks in the priesthood. They just wanted to wear black armbands, and the coach dismissed all 14 of them and stripped them of their scholarships. So in a way, we can see if we compare it with what happened at Missouri as a sign of progress, but at the same time, we can see that these issues are still going on. You know, we haven't seen an end point to these racial tensions on campus.
That was Jamie Schultz, associate professor of kinesiology at Penn State and a graduate of the University of Iowa. Her book is Moments of Impact: Injury, Racialized Memory, and Reconciliation in College Football.
And up next, we have another recent book of scholarship that deals with racial issues on the University of Iowa's campus. This book is called Invisible Hawkeyes, and as you might imagine from that title, the stories in this book about the African-American UI students have received a lot less attention.
And this time, we're not talking about athletes. We're actually talking mostly about artists. They came to the University of Iowa during the long civil rights era when the University of Iowa was trying to create a name for itself as a school that deserved international attention for blending arts and scholarship. The book was edited by two associate professors in the University of Iowa's English department, Lena and Michael Hill, and I sat down with them last October. Hello, Lena.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so happy to be here, Charity.
And Michael Hill, Associate Professor of English and African American Studies at the University of Iowa, the co-editors. This book covers a period roughly between the 1930s and the 1960s, and also explores kind of a unique relationship between these public universities in the North and the students in the South. So help us understand what was going on. Why did these universities become something of a destination for black students?
Yes, well, it really is an interesting moment in history. As many states found themselves under really duress and that the NAACP was bringing cases, noting that these states were not following what Plessy v. Ferguson actually said had to happen, and that was that you either had to provide an institution where African-American students could attend or allow them access, separate but equal. And as these institutions found that they didn't want to do that, they would often give funds to African-American students to pursue their education in other states that would welcome them. The University of Iowa was one of those state institutions, one of those public institutions. And so...
And did the University of Iowa and other public colleges in Iowa and in the North, did they have to welcome African-American students because there weren't other colleges? We talk about historic black colleges. Those institutions weren't here.
You are so right. For the University of Iowa, actually, there was a court case in 1867, a Supreme Court case in the state of Iowa that said they could not discriminate. But you point out another interesting part of this story, that many HBCUs needed spaces for students to get higher degrees so that they could actually have professors that could come and teach in those institutions. So that was another reason that many of these black students sought out spaces like the University of Iowa. So the University of Iowa had been accepting African-American students for many years. We had our first African-American graduate in 1879. But as word of mouth spread, that was one reason that the pipeline grew in many ways. And then as students had experiences and received their education and went back to HBCUs, they told others. And so students continued to come.
Now, the numbers of students that came were not very many. And we have talked about the experiences of black athletes on this program in the past. Athletics was an area where the number of African-American students grew early on, because this also made, of course, the athletic programs a lot stronger. But the two of you point out that it's not just the athletic programs, but the arts programs that welcomed a much higher number of African-American students. Michael, why the arts?
I think that the University of Iowa is struggling to establish itself as a national and an international institution in the 1930s through the 1960s. One of the bellwether movements that takes place on this campus has to do with the movement of recognition of artistic expression for academic credit So going back to Dean Carl Seashore and his decision ultimately to recognize academic and artistic expression as on equal par. So when you look across the nation, this is a sort of a leading edge development when you look at the University of Iowa. The University of Iowa is at the head of this kind of development. And because they need talent, when you look across all of the artistic schools at the University of Iowa, all of them are committed to a sort of colorblind framework as far as talent is concerned. And this is not an institutional mandate that comes from on high. You know, it's not a centralized bureaucratic admonition that each school is sort of developing. Rather, it's a byproduct of what has been understood as the charismatic leadership of each individual school. So when you look at figures like Mabee, when you look at figures like Engel, when you look at these folks operating within the sphere, when you look at someone like Clapp operating in the School of Music, each individual space is making decisions about how to define itself in a national and an international way at a crucial moment in the history of the university. The University of Iowa is not the University of Iowa as we understand it in the 21st century in the 1930s. I mean, in many people's mind, there is still a sense of flyover country. There is still a notion of the heartland, the yawning middle. You know, there are all kinds of epithets that are connected to it. But this is particularly acute, I feel like, in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. This is a moment where the university is seeking to put itself on the map. And the story of it arriving on the map has been told. But what's been fascinating and underexplored is the way that there are black collaborators that are taking place in very intimate ways in the arrival of the University of Iowa on the map. And this is the reason why I think it has so much resonance within the broader narrative of the civil rights movement and is underexplored as a dimension of the civil rights movement.
The athletes that came to campus, they had to be extraordinary athletes to be recruited, to be brought to the University of Iowa or other public institutions. And they were brought here on scholarships and, again, to enhance the athletic community. They also were very high profile on campus. With these artistic students who were coming to the theater department, to the music department, and we'll talk about the writer's workshop here in just a couple of minutes as well, were these students in some ways the equivalent of the athletes? Were they the individuals that were above and beyond everyone else in their community, Lena?
Not really. And I think that Fannie Ellison, who came here as Fannie McConnell and later married Ralph Ellison, provides a wonderful example. Fannie was actually pursuing her undergraduate degree at Fisk in Nashville. She was very happy. She was working with a luminary like James Weldon Johnson, who was a very important figure in the Harlem Renaissance. But as many students can relate to even today, she was struggling with her finances and ended up finding that she could not afford to complete her studies at Fisk, and came to the University of Iowa and to the theater department, which was the Department of Speech and Dramatic Art at the time. E.C. Mabee was then the very charismatic leader and really was putting Iowa on the map as a serious space to pursue a degree in theater. But no, Fannie didn't come as some highly sought-after student. What she did come to, though, was a cutting-edge theater department. We are enjoying so many ribbon cuttings today. Well, in 1936, Iowa opened its what at that point was an amazing theater department as far as all of the bells and whistles. They were really ahead of the curve and just the technological ability. So Fannie was excited, but no, she was not in any way feted as some sort of important star student. But she worked really hard. Again, segregation was something that was happening. It wasn't official. I think in the way that Dora talks about, things weren't said directly to you, but you could not be on stage in a major performance as an African-American student. You could help. She worked in many, many plays and had good experiences with friends. But yes, she couldn't act on stage in any of the major performances and definitely went away with somewhat of a bitter taste, even though she really valued the experience and the educational opportunity she received here.
There was a community in Iowa City at the time, and a lot of it was focused around Bethel Church, an African Methodist Episcopal church in Iowa City. One of the people that you profile in your book, Diana Penny, came from Muscatine, but her father was involved in the church. She came to Iowa City and studied, but had moved here also with her family. That church community was vitally important to so many of these students. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Michael?
Sure. The search for institutions that ground you within what I sometimes refer to as white spaces. Part of what we're understanding as far as pluralistic democracy or the notion of multiracial democracy is that as you move from segregation, a nourishing community, a set of institutions that are arrayed in a predictable fashion that you can draw upon and you understand the social mores that are connected to them. When you integrate, as you move into spaces, especially a situation like college, which is unique in some sense, when you integrate undergraduate spaces, you're moving away from home, right? You think about Mrs. Berry's experience. You're moving 1,000 miles away from home. You're completely set adrift with regard to the institutions that are familiar to you, the spaces that you would go to for food, the spaces that you would go to for basic services, the way that you would conduct yourself in worship, the way that you would operate as far as social supports are concerned. So when you move into a space like Iowa City, when you arrive here and you're looking around, one trope that emerges is a question of housing, right? Like the literal search for a dwelling, the literal search for a domicile. I would suggest that Bethel AME constitutes a metaphorical search for home.
One of the stories, and I'm having a hard time remembering which student this was that shared this story, but she was Catholic and didn't find that community because she belonged to the wrong church.
Yeah.
And, you know, just how difficult that made her life at the University of Iowa to not have that kind of support. Before we run out of time, I want to talk about the Writer's Workshop because, and Michael, you wrote the chapter on the Writer's Workshop, a really interesting history of reaching out to African-American writers, but just one at a time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a axiomatic understanding, not only in, I think, the history of the Iowa Writer's Workshop, but also within broader African-American literary history. The notion of ascendancy of a single personality at any given point in time, the notion of genius as understood via a regime of singularity. What happens is that it's impossible for a cohort, it's impossible for a group, it's impossible for a cluster, it's impossible for three or four people to constitute genius all at one time. And I think we see it very clearly within the world of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. For whatever reason, what's fascinating about the Iowa Writers' Workshop, however, is it deviates a bit from what Lena was talking about earlier. I would say that the first student that we know of, we still aren't clear because for some reason that I don't completely understand, the workshop downplays its racial accomplishments. Like it will downplay the fact that writers of a particular race were present at the workshop at a certain moment. So the reason that's relevant is because we still don't really know definitely whether Margaret Walker is the first African-American to be in the workshop because mm-hmm. the workshop won't confirm or deny whether or not she is the first person, first African-American to be at the workshop. The reason I bring up Walker, however, is that she existed within the world of the workshop as a star. She does enter with a tremendous publishing record and reputation. And Engel is very quickly moving towards a star-centered orientation. And my colleague Lauren Glass has talked about this at great length, the notion that stars will move into the world of the workshop and that the workshop will establish its reputation on the basis of stars. When Flannery O'Connor comes through, then people are like, oh, here's a star. We have a star. And the prestige of the workshop goes up in a commensurate fashion. What's fascinating about Walker's appearance is that it exemplifies that notion of antagonistic cooperation that Mrs. Berry was talking about earlier. When she comes into the workshop, there's a story that she tells about Engel lecturing her with regard to balance.
This is Paul Engel, the director of the workshop.
Yeah, so Engel is saying, you need to use ballads. You need to write in a ballad form. You're too angry. You're ultimately a little bitter. Why, you know, you need to write a nice old ballad. And Walker calls him onto the carpet with regard to this particular prescription. She says, you know, you're patronizing, you know, like you're condescending, and ultimately you don't understand the power of my poetry. And Engel says, you're absolutely right. You know, he admits it. And I think that that moment, you know, those kinds of moments add up. And we don't see them. They're not publicly visible. It's not something that's on the record. But in the world of invisible Hawkeyes, hopefully we can pull some of that stuff out in order that people can see that a space like the workshop had those moments, and we can catalog them, and we can start to account for them within the broader history of the institution.
Now, on the University of Iowa campus, on campuses everywhere, we still have racial issues that we are working on, we need to be working on. What, in this moment in time, do you feel like we can take away from these stories? Lena?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, I think we can just be inspired by the fact that students often made strides together, collaborating together, and I mean students, both black and white, move forward sometimes before the administrations, right? I mean, I think the election of Dora tells us that in 1955, even though it was not officially acknowledged.
The students were ahead of the institution.
And also, I think that excellence matters, that many of these stories are about African-American students who made their mark both here but beyond their work at the University of Iowa, in the world, in their careers, because they came to the University of Iowa, they worked incredibly hard, they forced both their peers and their teachers and their professors to acknowledge their talent and their brilliance in their chosen fields, and that was something that could not be ignored and that allowed them to contribute not just while they were on campus, but to the HBCUs they went to teach at, and as well as really to the nation that was the beneficiary of those talents.
Lena and Michael Hill, they are co-editors of the book Invisible Hawkeyes, African Americans at the University of Iowa During the Long Civil Rights Era. And in both of these interviews about racial tensions in the past on Iowa's college campuses, we, of course, ended up talking about the continuing racial tensions of today, because clearly this is an issue that has not been put to rest.
So we spent this time in this episode talking about racial tensions, and next week we have marital tensions to look forward to.
All right. But it's a really great novel. Dean Bacopoulos will be the guest. He is the author, most recently, of the book Summer Long.
Thanks for stopping by Lit City. See you next time.